So the title of my talk is Fitness Landscapes and Seascapes. And of course, in Santa Barbara, that there's not much I need to motivate this. So this is what you see when you look from one side out of the institute. And this is what you see possibly if you look out on the other side. So I will talk about those. And we'll see how we get there. It's sort of a mixture between an introductory tutorial on a quantitative evaluation of these fitness landscape, and then leading up to some more recent stuff. And this is people who have been mainly responsible for this recent stuff. Wilhelm Mustonen, who is here among us in the audience and will give a talk on another topic on bacterial promoters, which I will touch upon really briefly today. Probably next week, and he's also done work on non-equilibrium evolution Drosophila, which I will talk about today in some more detail, and some of the underlying statistical theory for adaptive evolution and its quantitative evaluation was done in collaboration with Johannes Berg, who is now an independent research group leader in Cologne, and who will join the program later, and graduate students at Vilma. So let me give yet another motivation for the title, which is coming from the titles of our workshop. So clearly there is two title words, evolution, and from the point of evolution it is very clear why we care about fitness and its quantitative evaluation, because it's one of the major driving forces for evolutionary change. Not the only one, but one of them. From the point of view of molecular networks, it may seem not as obvious from the outset. You could take a systems biology modeling viewpoint saying, well, if we want to understand something like a network of genes interacting in some ways, what we have to do is to study it experimentally and then maybe put all the experimental machine into a big model with coupled equations and try to understand this network mechanistically. Why should we care about how it evolved in the first place? Now, one answer, and the answer taken in this talk, is we should care because the organism cares. If we want to distinguish what is random about these networks, what is accidental, from what is necessary for the function of these networks, then the way organisms define what is necessary is whether I remove that part, there is a fitness cost evolved into that.
We'll work on that later. The organism measures how much it cares about a part of the network by a fitness cost. And so, as I will argue, in many ways, the only way to establish whether something is an essential part of a network or a random part is by trying to assess this fitness difference. We'll come to this point in a bit more detail later. The other facet to this motivation is, of course, a dynamical one. Fitness, the quantitative evaluation of fitness coefficients governs whether some parts of a network can form quickly or can reorganize quickly. So as an example that Tomoko Ota talked already this morning about, let's take promoter evolution. If you look at these complicated eukaryotic promoters, they have a complicated array of different binding sites for different transcription factors. And if we believe that a lot of the evolutionary differences between different species are due to regulation, then this may be an attractive idea, but it yet has to be shown whether it's dynamically viable, whether the system can, in a sufficient amount of time, reorganize or rewire its components via these microscopic, via the modification of these biophysical binding mechanisms, i.e. these binding sites, and whether or not it can do this with a sufficient tempo is dependent on a quantitative evaluation of these fitness coefficients. So, and this is sort of the next few slides will be known to many of you. They're just designed to set the stage for what will probably come up in many of the talks in this week and the following weeks. So why is it difficult to access quantitatively fitness effects in an organism, at least if you look in a genomic scale? Well, let's first define what we mean. If we were in a completely deterministic world, we would just say, okay, a fitness difference is just governs the frequency change of two alleles in a population, means the relative abundance of individuals which have allele A versus allele B, and if they have a fitness difference delta F, then this fitness difference is what we mean by that is just a difference in these growth rates. So we would have, in a growing population, we would have just a difference, the ratio of two exponentials, and if we keep the total population size constant, this would come to a logistic curve governing how much in abundance the fitter allele gains over the less fit allele. So that definition seems straightforward, and in experiments where fitness differences are strong enough so that this deterministic effect is dominant, it is straightforward. We put these two variants of the population in a petri dish, for example, in a bacterial culture, and just look after a few days how these relative abundances have changed. This is time. And it's time here measured in these characteristic units. The characteristic time is the fitness difference. So the bigger the fitness difference is, the faster fitter allele wins. Now, the difficulty that I've talked about comes about because these deterministic effects take place in a stochastic context. So it is not only fitness differences that governs the abundance of alleles, but stochastic effects due to reproductive fluctuations that are called deterministic drift, and Thomas Koota has also already mentioned them in many places of her talk. They come with a different characteristic time because they are in effect governed by the population size. So the typical time that an allele would need stochastically without any difference to travel through the population would be of order of the population size. In other words, you could say that this is a finite size effect, and the diffusion constant of this random walk would be of the order 1 over n. So there's already two different times that compete in our system, but there's yet another source of stochasticity, of course, and that is undirected random changes of the nucleotides in an individual. And by undirected, we mean that they have nothing to do at the level of the individual, whether they carry a positive or negative or no fitness effect at all. So, they have a rate 1 over mu, and hence a third characteristic time. They have a rate mu, and hence a third characteristic time 1 over mu. So now we have already three times, and this makes for a rather complex scenario. So here, this is the same graph as above. So here you would have an allele which comes with an initial 10% abundance in the population, and it would randomly by reproductive fluctuations changes frequency. Here in the lower panel, you see essentially the same thing, just that the time axis has been squeezed together. So now you see typical intervals where such a substitution process, such a change in allele frequency takes place. And then for a long while nothing happens, and then maybe a mutation in an individual happens. And if it so happens, it gains again more individual, it gains again a larger fraction in the population. So if you have just two alleles, A and B, and so the vertical axis is just the abundance of individuals of allele B, so that's a number between 0 and 1. So here they would be nearly all A. So occasionally you have such a mutation, but typically it doesn't make it very far in the population. It dies out again by chance. Yeah, typically, so what will happen here is that typically the whole population will again be A. So some small mutation dies out again. It doesn't make it through the population. But then there is new mutations taking place all the time in different individuals. So occasionally there is a macroscopic fraction of the population that gains the other allele, and it may take over the entire population. And then the game starts again.
What is the going down?
The going down is if the population was all B. And then, of course, there are new mutations. It's a different mutation. Yes. Every time is a different mutation. And so what you see here is a regime, which is, again, the regime that Tomoko Ota has talked about this morning, that is appropriate for most living beings, for most situations, except maybe for viral populations, where this time scale is much longer than this time scale. That means the typical time where this diffusion takes place is of order n, and the typical time between these mutations is of order 1 over mu. And the latter time being much longer means that typically the population has either A or B, with small exceptions, and there's these occasional flips between them. So what we call this a substitution. But the allele B has been substituted in the population, and that means it is the entire population up to maybe the occasional small exception here, which we wouldn't see in an experiment with finitely many individuals in a sample. And then occasionally there's a large-scale event replacing this by another allele. Suppose you make the mutations much more frequent, then you would be in your in the time dependence of this frequency, you would rather do small oscillation among some average, which would be determined by the ratio of the backward and forward fluxes in mutation. So then you would get into a mean field regime, and that's essentially the regime that the eigen-quasi species is in. So here we're talking about, so there's two different scaling regimes, one which will be relevant for this talk, and the other one, which is a deterministic scheme where the population size doesn't enter anymore, just mutations or and selection, which is in the quasi.
How was this generated by a bistable system? How did you generate this graph? Or is that?
Oh, this is just the diffusion of these alleles. So there's a stochastic process. Plus, there is, if there is a fitness difference, there is what physicists would call a drift term, is this diffusion equation, a bias towards uphill movement. And so you see the system is a little bit, likes to be a little bit more uphill than downhill, saying that for this particular simulation, the allele B, which corresponds to this population, to this fixed state, was a little bit fitter. But here, the simulation, as you can also see, has been done in the weak selection regime that Tomoko Ota described this morning. So while there is a difference between these two fixed states, it is not overwhelming. Had the fitness difference between been much higher, then you would not find any fixed state. You would never find a fixed state in the less fit allele.
So which regime are we in? And does that depend on like the size of the locus that we're considering?
Well, let's at the moment think about fairly small loci. If you think about a very large collection of sites, then you will have always coexisting polymorphisms in it. But then the question is really how strongly do they interact? And so let's, if we talk about a single locus, for example, a single nucleotide position, or maybe it's true even for a small collection of nucleotides, like in a transcription factor binding site, then typically we will see this in one copy in the population in a fixed state up to some exceptions. So for example, in fly, the abundance of these polymorphisms is relatively high. We're talking about 1 or 2%. So if you take a sample of 20 flies and you look down the genome, in 95% or 98% of the positions, you will find that all these 20 genomes have the same letter, meaning that we are sort of here. There could be a very small percentage of the flies that have another allele, but we wouldn't see it from a small sample. And in a relatively small fraction of the positions, we would be at a point where maybe 50% of the population have one allele, 50% have the other allele. So if we take a sample of 10, we'll maybe find 4 to 6, or 6 to 4, or 5 to 5.
Just to make sure that we are on the same page, mu is per genome per generation, right? You did.
No, mu is per position per position. Okay. Generation.
I see.
Yes. So in this regime where population size does matter, we then have a stochastic process that is governed by limitations, the population size, and the selection difference. And the famous diffusion theory by Kimura and Ota explains us that the substitution rate in a population, that means the rate by which these large-scale events occur, depends on all these three characteristics. It depends on, of course, the rate by which this same change would occur in an individual times a correction factor. The correction factor is a formula in which both the population size, i.e. the diffusion constant of this stochastic process, and the fitness difference between these alleles, i.e. the deterministic component of this process, enters. And this correction factor is something which you just have to remember for the remainder of this talk, the rough characteristics of this shape. So it's dependent on the ratio of two of our timescales, namely the diffusion timescale, times divided by the characteristic timescale of the deterministic component. And it is precisely one if the fitness difference is zero. So that is the original famous result of Kimura, that if we are at neutral evolution, then the replacement rate in a population precisely equals the mutation rate in an individual, which is a highly non-trivial statement, and it accelerated asymptotically linearly for a positive fitness effect and exponentially suppressed for negative fitness effects. And one mathematical property of this formula that is extremely simple but will become important in a moment, is that you just take the ratio of the forward rate and the backward rate for the same process. So you just replace in this formula this fitness difference, delta F, by its negative fitness difference. So that's the downhill process. That is equal to the ratio of these individual mutation rate times the ratio of these correction factors, and they just happen to be an exponential of the fitness difference. So this is like in physics, where the underlying distribution is a Boltzmann distribution, and we will see how this Boltzmann distribution pops up in this context. So here, the ratio of these forward and backward rates follows a very simple formula. Let's see that in a second. This is just a statement about these substitution rates. At the moment, it's just a statement about these rates. It will govern then the equilibrium. So clearly, if you look back here, this picture, that ratio of the uphill rate and the downhill rate also governs the ratio of the time that you find the system uphill. Yes. But one is going, it's the backward mutation. One changes an allele A in an allele B, and one changes B into A. Yes, exactly. So if one has a fitness effect delta F,
I'm trying to say, Michael, beforehand you said the two sides of the hill, there are two different mutations. So this picture does not immediately apply to the situation that you are describing in the next slide.
Well, let's,
you are talking about real going back.
Well, different, I think we just need to define what we mean by the word different. So by different, I meant independent mutation. So you have maybe a population that consists only of A's. Then the first guy gets a B. If this is favorable, it implies a fitness increase. And if this individual is lucky, becomes the founding father of all this large ever-increasing component of B's in the population till finally the population has reached a B-only composition. And then a new mutation, that means a mutation in a different individual happens, that somebody gets again an A. And if this fitness decrease, which is now minus delta F,
a real back mutation
at the same locus.
It's very rare.
It's rare, yes. And it takes, but it's not so rare that it doesn't take place. So bioinformatics people take the multiple hits always into account. So here we were talking about something that could take place at any point in the genome, and then of course we have to add up all the possibilities in the genome, but we'll see. We'll get to how rare it is if you accumulate that. So now a new individual gets the A, and this has a minus delta F, and that would bring the population, if drift wins in this case, back to an A-only standard. And if we in a Gedanken experiment do this for a very long time at one genomic locus, then we end up with an equilibrium state where we'll have sometimes we have zero, that means that they consist only of A's, and then some fraction of the time they will consist mainly of B's. And clearly, if we know the ratio of this uphill and this downhill rate, we also know the ratio of the times that we find a population uphill and find a population downhill. And we'll see how we put this to use in genomic analysis. But so it's clear, the moment we're just making a statement about these rates, but the rates govern the equilibrium chance that we have.
Time taken to
infinity, or
is time still running?
So is it the statistical mechanics thing that is T is taken to infinity or not? When you say equilibrium? Well, I mean, we wait a long enough time so that many changes will have happened, and then we, in that sense, it's a lot. But,
So UAB
is the substitution rate, and by this we mean the rate by which we would observe these large scale events in a population. So here, so if we mark every time we get a new fixation of this and call this a substitution event, then we would have here a substitution event where the B wins. Here's the next event where the A wins. Here is the next event where the B wins.
So the operational definition, we really look at complete fixation as opposed to 0.9 fraction fixation.
Yes, and then you can discuss how much how how dependent it is whether you call it 0.99 or 1.0, and it doesn't. It turns out to be asymptotically independent of that. But since there is a finite probability that actually the entire population gets fixed, you can take that as an operational definition. So, but you are allowed to sort of draw here a line of observational accuracy and talk about replacement up to this observational accuracy. And then you can count here the number of uphill events per unit in time, and that defines U up, and then there's a U down.
Okay. Am I correct that we are working on a level of a single nucleotide or a single amino acid? Because only in this case I could imagine a situation where you truly have this mutation which puts you back to the previous, that kind of, I pick up the Doron's question, because you said that we have to take into account the situations when A mutates to B and then B back mutates to A. If you are working on a level of a single gene, then it's much more likely that A mutates to B and then B would mutate to something else, altogether different.
Yes, so here we talk at the moment, let's just talk about two letters at any given position in the genome. And then how different position in the genome, what their temporal order is, we're going to come to this.
But in this case, I'm confused about how could we assign a fitness to a single letter mutation, because I guess fitness is a function which is defined on the level of an organism and not on the level of a single letter.
Well, that's a good point. And in many cases, these differences will be rather small. On the other hand, they can also be rather large. So there are these well-known examples where a single nucleotide difference causes a genetic disease, and so that will be a rather large fitness decrease. So that is then part of the difficulty to say how the organismic fitness, which is the sum of all these small, of all these nucleotide contributions, how that is composed. And then there's all these questions about epistasis and so on. But so at the moment, we just think about, in an operational definition, about two populations which are otherwise identical, or two subpopulations, differing just in this one allele difference. So the next slide has to do with another facet of this discussion, and this the fact that fitness effects vary by orders of magnitude. And this is very crucial if we want to compare different experimental and genomic results. So here is again the zero, the fitness difference delta F, and Tomoko Ota has already pointed out that so the range of near-neutral changes are governed by the combination delta F times N. In other words, delta F being between 1 over N and minus 1 over N. That is the regime where the diffusive part, the stochastic part, is dominant. And let's call this regime advantageous mutation and this regime deleterious mutation. And of course, there's a continuum here. And if the fitness differences are really big, of order 1, then we really see this immediately in a petri dish, that after a few generations, this variant has died out. We can call it lethal. And similarly, we will have no difficulty in discerning a strongly positive fitness effect. But the point I want to make is that experiments, and for that model systems biology models, which put this thing on a computer, really probe the effect of maybe, well, as many generations as we are willing to wait in experiments, which can be of the order of 100 or 1,000 for a bacterial experiment. So that means we are probing the fitness effects at both ends of this scale, up to maybe 10 to the minus 3 at the most. Effective population sizes tend to be much larger. They can be 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. So there is a different scaling. So the distinction between the stochastic and the deterministic regime is, by deterministic we mean that up to maybe some initial effect in the population, once the mutation has made it to a small fraction of the population, it will, with high likelihood, make it through the population, or on the negative side, it will, with high likelihood, not make it through the population. So there is a whole large regime of changes which make sense for the organism. So they cannot be discarded as purely random. They are part of the evolutionary design, but they are not detectable neither by direct modeling nor by direct experiments, simply because we cannot wait the sufficient number of generations. They are, however, detectable by genomic analysis. So polymorphisms, on the other hand, center on this part of the fitness range scale. So things that are in this 0-1 range, or maybe a little bit further to this side, roughly till 1 over the sample size that we pick, they are detectable by polymorphic studies. Still, there is a gray zone of things which are not very well detectable by either method. So this is the rendering of the first picture of this of the title page. So what we should be aware that these experiments, the direct experiments and the models, probe rather different fitness scales. So if we think, for example, of the bacterial experiments described by Sander Tuns, by Ivan Martic, and by Susie Raymold, if we talk about antibiotic resistance of bacterial cultures, they are subject to large doses of a new antibiotic, so they're subject to large fitness differences. So the present type of the population is then largely unfit, and there's a relatively fast response by some mutants. So this is the regime of strong fitness differences, where we distinguish between badly viable or unviable phenotypes and more viable phenotypes, and evolution is correspondingly fast. On the other hand, what may drive the differentiation between different populations in a wild type may not involve fitness differences of the same order of magnitude. It may not be between unviable and viable population, but sort of low energy differences that take a much longer time to fix. So that means if we get from an experiment information on the fitness landscape, for example, the downhill path are not allowed or so, it's not immediately clear how this scales down to the typical fitness differences that may govern these more subtle differences in wild-type population. That's really an open question. So we have to be careful when we interpret these experiments. So now we come back to evolutionary equilibrium. So this is the situation we have already described. There is a fixed state in one allele, and then there's maybe a substitution, and so on. So again, here, this state would be a little bit fitter, as you see, because it's a little bit higher chance to be uphill than downhill. And if you wait long enough, and then the average probability to find the population at a given value of x is described by an equilibrium distribution. And in this case, there is what physicists call detailed balance. So that means if you just look, and for each downhill move, there is precisely one uphill move. The number of deleterious substitution and the number of advantageous substitutions are exactly equal. This does not say, of course, that the chance, the probability, the rate of going downhill is, of course, much lower than the rate of going uphill, but a product of the probability of being downhill times the uphill rate is equal to the probability of being uphill times the downhill rate. And we know since the work of Kimura and Ota how to theoretically treat this case, namely by mapping these sort of stochastic trajectories onto a diffusion equation, and then we can talk about Fokker-Planck or Kolmogorov equation governing the time dependence of this frequency distribution and solve a lot of things mathematically. Now, this comes back to Doron's question. So we can actually, the notion of this equilibrium state, it's valid in a little bit more general way. Namely, if you go back at the substitution processes here in their statistics, then remember the ratio between the uphill and downhill is just exponential of the fitness difference. And that would mean that we know exactly whatever the fitness landscape is, and whatever complicated the moves are in a larger sequence space that are allowed, we know exactly the form of the equilibrium distribution. It is just the Boltzmann distribution with an argument of n times the fitness. And why is that? Because the simple detailed balance relation says if we have a distribution which is thus exponential to the 2 times f, then for any possible substitution channel between any two states, A and B, the forward current and the backward current precisely annihilate. So this is an equilibrium state. So for an arbitrary fitness landscape, we know immediately the form of the equilibrium state. So this is, we can put this to use. Suppose we have like two families of genomic loci, one moving like sort of under neutral evolution, the other under selection. So then we would just get the fitness landscape by taking the log of Q divided by P. And in other words, from bioinformatic counting of the relative abundances. So let me give an example of this. And let me brief about it, because this is going to be described in more detail in Ville Mustonen's talk next week. If, for example, we take a family of transcription factor binding sites, of course, this relation here as it stands is not yet very useful, because a sequence space, even of a transcription factor binding site, is a 4 to the 10 different sequence states. So we can hardly count things and would get undersampling. We could hardly fill our histograms. But if we...
How do you define fitness landscape? You say equilibrium fitness landscape is given by some equation. How do you define the fitness?
Well, let me walk through this example and see if I can make it clear here in this example. So we take, for example, the binding energy as a phenotype and just project everything on the binding energy. So then we would count in our genome the number of occurrences in functional binding sites which are given value of the binding energy, and we would count in the genome the occurrences of non-functional binding sites with a given value of the energy. Let me not comment on how this is done precisely, but we would get two different distributions as a function of the binding energy. And the recipe would say, oh, well, let's just take these two distributions, take the ratio of them and take the log, and then we get a fitness function as a function of this phenotypic variable, the binding energy. And this fitness function is just determined by the relative abundance of the red curve with respect to the blue curve, saying that where I find more of the red sites, I find more because they are uphill on a fitness landscape, and hence the probability of a given binding site, hopping around in this fitness landscape is higher to be uphill than to be downhill. So this is a simple generalization of what we have seen here for a single locus. It was more probable to be uphill than to be downhill. But since the evolutionary form of this, since the form of this equilibrium is so simple, we can take the same formula, for example, for these binding sites. And then from the ratio of abundances, we can directly measure fitness coefficients. And as Tomoko Ota was pointing out, they are just sort of at the borderline of the diffusive regime, where the diffusion matters a lot, and the selective regime. In fact, just as a side remark, they are even more near neutral than you would think just by looking at this number 10 here, which would be quite high, a selection coefficient for a single site. But for these binding sites, there is sort of an additional entropic effect, because there is many more possibility of getting a non-binding site than a binding site. So this selection difference is in any way such that it is always possible to lose a given site by drift. And this is presumably one of the reasons why we see such a high binding site turnover between different species. As for example, Tomoko Ota was mentioning the example of Ludwig and Kreitmann and different binding site compositions in different flies.
There was a rather big jump between talking about distribution of frequencies of allele in a given locus in the population to the frequency of binding sites on a single genome.
Yes.
And basically talking about affinity, one can imagine that the reason, there are other reasons for having binding sites with different affinity.
Yes.
Which has to do with the level of cyclic AMP that particular CRP has to respond to.
Right. So this is obviously what this analysis assumes, and we can argue that for this example which was treated here, this is not too bad assumption, is that to get an order of magnitude estimate, we assume that the fitness effects are comparable for all these sites in this genomic family. So we average over the different selection pressures that may be on one site that is in front of one gene, has a more important regulatory function, another site, another gene has a less important regulatory function. So these differences would be swept under the carpet by this kind of ensemble building.
And is there a way of falsifying the statement?
Yes. And this is what Ville Mustonen will talk about. If we know the typical or if we get an order of magnitude estimate of typical fitness differences, we can predict something. Maybe we can predict the amount of conservation that we would see between species. Because now this gives the size of the fitness hill between working sites and non-working sites, and we can compare that with what we find in cross-species analyses.
I can imagine picking some value of E, identifying some binding sites in with that value of E, and marking them up, and asking, your formula basically tells me what the fitness differential is. So I just compare wild type to mock out with different E's and three experiments, and you measure differential growth rate. Is that acceptable as experimental test?
The answer is in principle yes, except that you would have to wait longer than the typical completion time of a PhD. Because if if this statement is true, it means that typical binding sites are relatively weakly selected. So if n is of order 10 to the 6 for a bacterial population, typical fitness differences would be of order 10 to the minus 5, implying that you would have to wait 10 to the plus 5 generation in order to see the effect. So this is an example of something which is sort of deterministic at, if these numbers are correct, it's sort of deterministic at the evolutionary level. This binding site is needed. It's clearly something which has a fitness gain to it or a fitness cost if it's knocked out. But this number, so that means that 2n times this number is something substantial, but this doesn't preclude that the number itself is small, implying that in a direct experiment, you would have to wait for a rather long time to see the effect. This is this gray zone, which I was alluding to, between sort of what is reachable by direct experiment and what is deterministic in the sense that it is kept in the population for a reason. The former is governed by S, the latter is governed by N times S. You look
Have you actually looked at the sites that have this kind of weak binding? I mean, what kind of genes are these?
Well, so what we looked here is the pleiotropic binding sites, like these CRP sites in E. coli. There's an ongoing study which we do with Justin Kinney and Kurt Callan on yeast data, where the data situation is better, and in particular the definition of the binding energy matrix, which of course crucially goes into this axis, is better. So clearly one has to work on relatively pleiotropic sites in order to be able to form that ensemble. And the LACMUS test of whether these numbers make sense is if they have a predictive value. So you record something in one species, and you're not yet at the seascape part of the talk, and then you can say, well, knowing the amplitude of the fitness landscape, I should know quantitatively how conserved are sites. What is the chance of losing a site? So, and then these kind of observables can be measured independently as turnover rates between different species or the probability that a site is kept that you find in one species. And that way you can then put these sort of these predictions into a test.
Some of these genes, which is originally under control to not under this.
Yeah. So if, you know, I mean, if this is here, if this were 100 or 1,000, this would mean you would never lose a binding site. So there would be no turnover. If this is 0, it would mean that you would lose it all the time, because it's neutral evolution and it just randomizes itself very quickly. And the statement is it's just in between. So binding sites are kept, but maybe not for very long. And so this is the kind of dynamical statement that we can then test in cross-species analysis. And it has been tested, but don't want to go into details, because this is the subject of a different talk. So let's now think about what happens if our equilibrium assumption is violated. And clearly, so this in some sense it should rather this. It's quite obvious that it has to be violated, because biological evolution is not about equilibrium. There's innovations. And if it were just about equilibrium, we would all be like degenerate bacteria hopping like one state of binding and the other side of binding back and forth. So clearly there has to be something more. So let's assume that selection itself changes. And this is here in this simple model. So we have here what this shading indicates is that some point in time, let's assume that again on our single locus with just two alleles, just the sign of selection changes. So this is here what was the fitter allele before now becomes the less fit allele. And now even without any mathematics, it's of course clear what will happen. It's not difficult to see. So if the selection was sufficiently substantial, before the switch, the genome was more likely in the favored allele. This is what is here. So we have like high percentage of B's, say if B was the fitter allele. Now suddenly, as a function of this change, the genome finds itself in the disfavored allele, and then there is a response by an uphill move. So there's an adaptive response to this change in the fitness landscape. So something changes in the demand function, and then there's a response to this change. This is the picture we want to explore. But it's clear, if you look at it, again, if you wait for long enough time, then you reach again a stationary state. But in the tradition of physics, I would want to call this a non-equilibrium stationary state, meaning that there is a driving force that underlies this non-equilibrium stationary state, implying that detailed balance is violated. And indeed, we now have more uphill moves than downhill moves. So you can see that adaptation in this picture is just the excess of uphill moves over downhill moves. Because we did this switching, we triggered extra moves here, which would be the response. So there's now, if you count the number of moves that go from black to white over the number of moves that go from white to black, like this one, you will find more uphill moves than downhill moves because of the Sisyphus effect, because you have... No, this is why we call it non-equilibrium. Yes, we call it a stationary state, but let's call it non-equilibrium. No. The definition I want to use is that a stationary state is anything that doesn't change anymore over time. So here, if you wait a long enough time, it also this probability of finding some x will be just some number. So it will also not change over time. That sense is a stationary state. But let's call it a non-equilibrium stationary state because detailed balance is violated. Because due to this switching process, we have more uphill moves than downhill moves, which we could never have without the switching, because otherwise we would just have one downhill, and then the next one would have to be an uphill, and the next one would have to be a downhill. So that's why these two numbers had to be equal in equilibrium. So here, because we have a time dependence in the fitness, we can have more uphill moves.
But the assumption of stationarity for this P means that the switching rate is also kind of stationary, right?
Yes. Let's.
So, yeah. I mean, this is more. Is that reasonable biologically?
Let's come to that. So at the moment, we'll come to that in a minute. So this suggests a definition of what adaptation is, namely, and there is a variety of possible definitions that you find in the literature. So what I'd like to propose here is to define it as a non-equilibrium phenomenon, namely to define it as the response to these new selection pressures, and this is sort of what we are all used to on a phenotypic level. If we talk about, say, an incipient speciation of a population driven by disruptive selection, then there's something new happening, this disruptive selection, then there is a response to it, that the population acquires two different coexisting phenotypes that then can diverge. Or we think about migration, so there's a new habitat. And clearly there's something new, like the flies going from Africa to Europe and suddenly finding that there's something like winter. And then they have to do something about it and adapt to it. So the adaptation is a response to something that precedes it, namely a change in the fitness landscape. And this dynamical aspect is what we try to capture here by this picture. So This has, of course, this has a long tradition to think about time-dependent environments. And in fact, a lot of the classical papers and thoughts by Wright, Kimura, Ota, Gillespie, and a number of others have been influenced by the idea of modeling these environmental changes. So a lot of the this modeling was done for situations where the switching here is relatively fast. Fast, for example, with respect to the time that it takes, the time n that it takes for polymorphisms to travel in the population. So seasonal changes would be something of a fast fluctuating variable. And these fast fluctuating variables, you can sort of integrate into this diffusion ansatz and make modified diffusion equations. And there is a large literature about it. These modified diffusion equations tend to become a little bit complicated mathematically, and it's clear why they have to be complicated, because we have two different noises now in the system, two different stochasticities. One is genetic drift, and the second coexisting noise is the changing environment, and these two things conspire in a way that is not always easy. So if we have now adaptations, if we have something which goes up this fitness landscape, and then we can ask the question, can we find it in the genome? And this is again sort of a review slide. There's a number of classical population genetic tests that, so how could we detect if a change was due to a fitness increase? Now, for a single change at a given position, this is something hard, because then we will need to do, again, a direct experiment. But if we ask a slightly more modest question, how can we detect the relative statistical fraction of uphill moves and downhill moves from genomic data? So one way to detect this would be, of course, to go back to our dispersion relation somewhere here and say, well, there is an increased substitution rate over the neutral rate if and only if the fitness difference is positive. That means if we have a genomic category and we find, for example, an increased amount of changes with respect to the neutral rate, so that is something feasible if we look for protein coding sequences. We could then look at synonymous substitutions that do not change the amino acid, taking them as a proxy for near-neutral evolution. There are some fitness effects associated to it, as Tomoko Ota was mentioning this morning, but if they are not very strong, let's take them sort of as the most neutral that we can get. And if we were to find more replacement substitutions than synonymous substitutions, we would say, well, this is a sign that there was typical fitness increase with these non-synonymous substitutions. So this would be a stringent test for adaptive evolution, or at least for positive selection. And there are examples where this does occur. And one example is what we discussed last week in the influenza evolution. For those codons that encode hemagglutinin changes that are responsible for the interaction with the immune system, you find an increased ratio of non-synonymous changes over synonymous changes. So this hypermutation rate can be taken as an indication of adaptive evolution. The downside of this is that in most cases you don't find, so that stated here, the converse is not true. If you find less substitutions that change the amino acid than neutral evolution, it does not mean that there is no adaptive processes going on. It just means that it may be a subset of sites. So the fact that you find less changes does not yet tell you anything about the reasons for the changes that do occur. So, for example, if we look in the fly genome, we find in all genomic categories less changes than in four-fold silent substitutions. Does this mean that there are no adaptations in the Drosophila genome? No, because the remainder of the changes, so there can be an overall suppression, but of course there can be a subset of sites which still move uphill. How could we try to find those? Well, so people have thought about shrewd tests, and one of them, or in fact these two classes of tests that I want to briefly motivate, look again at polymorphisms, at the spectrum of polymorphisms. So one idea which underlies these tests that are based on polymorphisms is to say, well, if we go back to this picture, if the population is at this fitter allele, then it's very bad to go down here, then we would hardly see any substitutions going downhill. We would still see a boundary layer where the diffusion wins, so that the polymorphisms would still take place, maybe with a lesser typical amplitude, but there's still we would still find a certain boundary layer of polymorphism. In other words, if we draw the distribution, we would find something which is would still have some support here. So if this is maybe 0.1, and here is 1 in our scale, so if we have this distribution P, we would still find some polymorphisms, but they would be concentrated sort of in one corner of this percentage range. So if we find a distribution which is heavily centered in the corners, we would say, well, this is a sign of this boundary effect, and that would be negative selection, so you can't actually make the substitution. You may still make some polymorphism. On the other hand, if you go uphill, then it turns out that the polymorphism spends most of its time at the other end of this spectrum. So there is a way of just from looking at the form of this polymorphism spectrum to distinguish between which was downhill and which is uphill. And so there are several variants of this, but without going into too much detail, it should be clear that by looking at the shape of the spectrum, we can try to learn something, whether something moves uphill or downhill.
Sorry, you lost me. Your picture here has just one locus, and it's either up or down, like A or not A.
Yeah,
and you have a population, and all I have is a snapshot.
Yes.
So the number of A is 87%, another one is 13.
Right.
So where's the distribution?
So this is again.
We're looking at many polymorphisms of a given gene. What is the distribution of?
So this is again very related to the question that we discussed before. So now what people do is an even more bold lumping together of different genomic positions, and try to build up this distribution, which we derived or here depicted at a level of a time average at one given locus, building up the same distribution from the genomic averages at different loci at the same point in time, because as you point out, we just have a snapshot of all these.
But now my concern is that some of those positions will be neutral and others will be selected, right? So.
Yes. So this is.
Distribution is going to spread out and is going to have a very long tail because I'm picking up a neutral chunk.
Precisely. I have a next slide with confounding factors where this is number one and in fact the most important one. So this kind of statistic analysis involves an averaging over shapes with all sorts of negative delta Fs and positive delta S, and we really have to see whether from this uncontrolled average we can still get out something. But it's clearly this is very much of a concern.
I couldn't tell whether you were talking about the genus D or Ghana Price, but I didn't think it was an accurate description either.
I haven't talked about McCrone-Kreidman yet.
You haven't talked about it?
No. Okay. I talked about sort of a family of tests that use the shape information in the polymorphism spectrum, of which Tajima's D is one of them.
But Tajima's D really is more contrasting with the usual situation of pure bike selection with the unusual situation of balancing selection, which is something you haven't talked about because you're always talking about fixation. Balancing selection is where you maintain a polymorphism. That's really what Tajima's D is designed to.
Well, so here I have talked about polymorphic situation in the population. So here, the Tajima's D doesn't use the substitution. So Tajima's D you can get from one species.
But you haven't talked about it at all. You were talking about your model didn't even discuss balancing selection at all. It's a completely different kind of selection. Selection maintains a polymorphism. It keeps you in the middle. They're away from either of the extremes.
Well, balancing selection is one type of selection that
gives rise to one particular shape of this frequency spectrum. So much I agree. And
perhaps it would be nice that you define the frequency.
So the frequency spectrum, I'm sorry, maybe I should. So we would get.
You can draw a curve and define what X's are.
Right, so the frequency spectrum is what you get. If we take this time average, we would convert this random walk in a probability distribution. In other words, we ask, what is the probability of finding this random walk at a given value of x.
Find over a population, over many loci. And it's very powerful what you're talking about. You have to define it and then say what in the shape of it identifies different modes of selection.
Now, let me define it here. And I define it at a single locus as a. No, it is here. It is one locus, Doran, and there, and so it is. I can define it here as a time, as emerging from the time average of one locus. I can do that, and it is sort of. It has the conceptual advantage. So that locus, so things are well defined. Now we can assume that there is a family of many loci. Now we come to a genome and a population, and so here we have a population. So a certain fraction x of the population has allele A, and 1 minus x has allele B. Then we can talk about the probability distribution of finding x. That's what this P of x is. And if we wait long enough, then this will not change anymore, and let's call it stationary. Now we go to, but this is, as we just discussed, this is not the data situation that we have. The data situation is that we have at one given point in time, namely today, we can look at different loci in the genome, and then we can try to form classes of loci of which we think we could lump them together to reconstruct something like a frequency distribution. So, for example, one class would be four-fold synonymous changes in coding DNA. So then what we do is what people take is, say, in a given chromosome or a given region where they think that other things are not varying too much, they take all the fourfold silent changes and build up a histogram of how many, so if I sequence them from 20 individuals, then number one I would have maybe 20 out of 20 and 17 out of 20, and they build up a histogram. And this ensemble average, ensemble over different points in the genome, and here different fourfold silent sites, is then something which we may think or nothing to be equivalent to this stationary state here. But so this is then the operational definition how a frequency distribution would be obtained from a population. We would form a set of genomic positions that we decide to lump together to one distribution, with all the caveats that we just said, and then we would form a histogram of, say, if you have 20 individuals, then this axis would go from 0, 1 over 20, 2 over 20, up to 20 over 20. Well, so here would be this would be the probability of finding some x, or if we have a discrete probability distribution, it would be the probability of finding some number k, and this number k can be from 1 to our sample size, maybe if you choose 12 samples, then we can find either 0 of these individuals in allele A, or 1, or 2, or 3, or 11, or 12 out of 12 that we sequenced. And if we do this over a family of loci, we get a histogram. And this would be our sort of experimental way of getting something which, up to sort of sampling effects that people have calculated, is something that we think is similar to the frequency distribution in a population. Distribution meaning averaging over this family of loci that we decided to average about. Did this address your concern? No, I mean, do you have another definition?
I see the main problem is that is a historical average over a time which is very long compared to, say, the fluctuation time of the environment. And that one is an average of a different loci in the same genome. And it is, I don't think it's very obvious that the two things have something to say, unless you say that each locus that you are collecting is more or less in the same environment, which is really the base of the question.
I mean, we haven't yet, so I think maybe it shouldn't be misunderstood that these two things have to be identical. So we can, at a given locus, we can talk about a distribution by taking it at several points in time. And at different loci, we can talk about a distribution at a single point in time, taking them at different positions in the genome. Both give rise to distribution. So we haven't yet said that they need to be necessarily identical.
I think this is an interesting problem in itself.
Yes.
What is the relation?
Yes. So let's maybe... to be clear again, so that the operational definition, if we take what people do in genomic analysis, is they take a family of these loci of which they have reason to believe that they could be lumped together because they don't differ too much between each other. But of course, this is then part of the difficulties of this inference. So there is a second class of tests which takes into account not only the polymorphisms, but also the substitutions. So there we need to have the information from one population plus an outgroup population so that we can talk about something which is in a locus. We would have information on, say, these 12 individuals within one species plus the typical allele, or at least one individual, from another species. So then we can talk about substitutions and polymorphism.
I've sat through many talks where I listened to people talking about the McDonald Crichton, and I've never actually said it, but since everybody here seems to interrupt and talk about things, I might as well say it. That is simply not a valid test of adaptive evolution. And anybody who thinks that it doesn't know anything about population genetics, because you're comparing, first of all, two populations, two different species, usually. And you're almost certainly have gone through changes in effective population size in that history between those two species. Stresses of speciation usually involve some kind of a bottleneck. During the bottleneck, the rate of substitution of slightly deleterious mutations is going to increase compared to non-bottleneck situation. So what you're going to end up having, you're going to end up calling as adaptation what is really the fixation of slightly deleterious mutations. And this test is used all the time, and nobody ever points that out. Well, somebody has pointed it out in press, and everybody ignores it.
Well, I will point it out on the next slide. This is why you may have noticed that I said here indicated. I didn't say shows. So as Kreitman puts it himself, this is consistent with an adaptive scenario. It does not show it, and we'll go to the next. Wait for your final judgment on population genetics till the next slide, I would suggest. So for the moment, let me say the following. If you have substitutions and polymorphisms, you can talk about the relative ratio of substitutions with respect to polymorphisms. And of course, this is something which you can again compare with a neutral class. In a neutral class, it's known. This is roughly proportional to the evolutionary time. Well, this is for small times. It's something that accumulates with time times the mutation rate. The total number of polymorphisms is proportional to the product of mu times n. This ratio is something which you find in a neutral class, and if the ratio of substitutions to polymorphisms in another class is higher, then this is consistent with the fact that some of these substitutions are driven by a positive fitness effect, because for negative fitness effects, the substitutions are exponentially suppressed. However, the polymorphisms are just algebraically suppressed, and for positive fitness effects, the substitution rate is enhanced. So this may indicate if all the other things are there. For example, if the population size does not go through a bottleneck, that there is adaptation. Now, well, this is of course part of this. This discussion that goes on. So here is what makes this analysis difficult. The first thing that makes it difficult, and this is what we have already discussed, is that there is a spectrum of fitness effects in all the positions that you're lumping together in order to form this frequency spectrum. So if in a Tajima's D test you find one clear signature if some things go uphill, then in the same class you're lumping this together with things where things go downhill. So your curve is at best a certain average over these different shapes that you would get, and often blurred. So this is the main difficulty in a quantitative analysis, and it calls for actually a somewhat more sophisticated model building. The second thing that we haven't talked about is that the loci are linked on a genome. So what can be seen in the polymorphism spectrum at one locus may not be the selection at that locus, but the selection at a neighboring locus linked by it simply because they are sort of neighboring on the sequence that locus in question is carried along. This may not be so much of a concern if we just want to demonstrate whether the presence of selection is there, but when we want to quantify how many loci are affected, then this can grossly distort the proportions that we assign to any kind of selection, in particular positive selection or adaptations. Now comes your favorite point. A growing population can give a false sign in these variables that looks like as if adaptation were going on. Is that what you were alluding to? Now, there is a way of distinguishing adaptation and population growth as the causes for these spectral properties of polymorphisms, and this is that population growth affects simultaneously all classes of the genome. It's something that the population undergoes, but it doesn't, I'm not saying it affects all loci in the same way, because it interacts again with selection, but it's something that is common to the genome. But if we find characteristic differences in these properties between genomic classes, then we can hope to disentangle population growth effects from true selection effects. But this is something that any responsible analysis has to do. So in that much, I would agree with you that this is a problem. I would definitely disagree with you that we cannot use these frequencies of polymorphisms and substitutions to say something about adaptation.
Well, I guess, the thing that I see is that slightly deleterious mutations are the main thing that's going on. Deleterious mutations in general. And so the main thing that happens in a bottleneck is going to be, you get an increased substitution rate of slightly deleterious mutations. I mean, that's going to be like a very big signal. And that's going to be in almost all populations. Whereas adaptive evolution is some sort of hypothetical thing that maybe isn't going to be in those populations. And, like you were saying earlier, you said, well, there's no evidence of adaptive evolution in Drosophila, but that can't be true. Why can't it be true? Maybe it's true. Maybe their adaptive evolution is so rare that you're just not going to see it, and there's really not a lot of point in looking for it.
Well, maybe. Let's look. And then let's see. I mean,
a priori. Stringent methods that'll really show it, rather than just with things that, you can say, well, it might be there. Well, it might be anywhere,
Well, I mean, I guess you're using more maybes than I will use in the rest of my talk. So let's see what I'll tell you on the, not get too long. I will tell you in the next few slides what we think, what goes on in Drosophila, and then let's see.
I think there's another distinction. If you go back to one slide, actually, Hatimas P is a detection of any types of selection. It's not test of the tension. It's just whether there's a presence of selection or not.
I mean, this is why I said Tajima's D and its variants. So you can, there have been, what I lumped here together in these two lines was a family of tests that are based on the polymorphism spectrum. So, which do not use explicitly the substitution statistics with respect to outgroup sequences, although the more powerful variants use the outgroup for directioning this spectrum so as to sort of break this symmetry between the two sides, because otherwise if you have just one species you can't decide what is left or right on this spectrum. So there's a family of tests, and what I claim is from the shape of this distribution, you can read different kinds of selection. And Tajima's D test is one of them, and then there's this test by Akashi and so on, this whole family.
So you can still distinguish between different types of selection.
Yes, of course.
But it's not a test of adaptation. If you have a lot of negative selection, it still picks up. It doesn't mean that it's adaptation. But the McDonald and Kretman test is intended to test for positive selection. The purpose are different.
Well, that's.
And you have mentioned in the next slide, that's the first line, that exactly the complication. In Tajima's case,
I mean,
so it's a test of whether any kind of selection, not just positive selection.
Well, but you will agree that in the polymorphism spectrum, the presence of positive or negative selection, and all this is all that I meant to say in this rather summaric previous slide. Positive and negative selection will give rise to different shape characteristics. And by counting abundances of different polymorphisms in one way or the other, however we name this in detail, we can try to say something about, say, is it balancing selection, is it predominantly negative, is there some component of positive, and so on. So this we can try from the polymorphism spectrum with all these caveats that, and I should have put some dots here, there's some more. There is one more caveat that I would like to emphasize, because it will affect that in cases where we don't have a very good local neutral standard, like in intergenic regions. So in cases where there's lots of neutrality around, then we would just have a neutral standard. If it is true, for example, that in the fly genome there is not so much strict neutrality around in intergenic regions, then we would not have a local neutral standard by which we can compare things to, which would affect things like the McDonald-Friedman test. For example, insertions and deletions for this kind of different processes, different from point mutations, we don't have the benefit of fourfold silent changes, which we can take as a proxy for the most neutral thing that we can get. Similarly, if we think about other kinds of data, like expression data, like the population genetic analysis of expression data that Tomoko Ota was talking about this morning, between different mammals, including the human lineages, again, one of the problems is what is our neutral gold standard that we can use to then see these departures from. Well, there's two more things that I will come to the next slide in more detail. I think part of the problem is that all these tests operate with deviations from a neutral hypothesis, but there's no dynamical modeling of what is actually going on in a model with leads them to adaptive selection. And part which has come up in this discussion already, polymorphism spectra and substitutions, so this is they form part of something which is generated by one statistical process. But in all these different tests, different aspects of this are combined to treat different solutions. So it can happen, and it does happen sometimes, that the data give conflicting information from these different tests. And then the question is how to decide about them. In other ways, these we need to think of, can we score in a more coherent way these different partial aspects of the statistical information available. So now I'm coming to getting to what we think this work on the Drosophila genome, the selection we inferred here. So the rationale we started from is to say, let's go back to our phenotypic concept of adaptation, where adaptation is a response to a dynamical change in the fitness. And let's try to see if we can infer the time dependence of selection together with this adaptive response. So this is what was in the cartoon, the switches which triggered the response. Of course, in the genome it's more complicated, but let's try to make a model of time-dependent selection and model this driving force together with the response. So selection is promoted from something which is just there, positive or negative selection in certain fractions in the genome, to a dynamical model itself. And then we model this together with the response of the gene. So this model that we take is again something rather simple. We take at a given locus a fitness difference between the alleles. So if we think about at the moment just two alleles at every locus, then there is an amplitude which is not changing in time and a direction which is changing in time. This was what was depicted in this cartoon a few transparencies ago. And the direction of selection is fluctuating with a certain rate gamma. So this model is, of course, the venerable, or a simple version of the venerable fluctuating selection models that have been treated in the literature for a long time. The advantage of this model is that, as simple as it is, you can analytically solve it in a certain regime, so this is a misspelling here, where the fluctuation rate is smaller than the typical travel time of polymorphisms. So at the level of substitution dynamics in a population, this driven non-equilibrium model is analytically solvable. And the way this can be done is what you could call in physics like a quasi-stationary approximation. The fast process of the replacement of one allele by the other is condensed to a single sort of jump, just from one fixed state to another fixed state, and then we just have a driven jumping process which we can solve. And it's a little bit in that limit, the simultaneous presence of these two kinds of noise, the reproductive fluctuations and the switches in selection, can be compared to temperature and quench disorder in a physics system. So this is just a side remark for the physicists, because in this case they have different timescales associated to it. So now let's come back to sort of the what we people and we get by sort of a genomic analysis from polymorphisms and substitution. So in this case, what we took was two Drosophila species. So there is a number of individuals from one species being sequenced, plus maybe one individual from the other species. And this is what you will typically find in most cases if these two species are not too far away. All the individuals in one species plus the individual in the other species will share the same letter. In a certain subset of these sites, you will find that all the individuals in one species have the same letter, but the other species has a different letter. That's what's called a substitution. And so we just label this here by the number of individuals that is different. So this would be all the eight here. So most columns you have a zero. This is like typically 5 or 6% for these two Drosophila species that we compared, that you would find this situation. And in an even lesser fraction of the cases, you would find something a part of the species, the individuals in one species have the same letter here as the other species, and another part differs, in which case we would not record that number. So the outcome... Yes, well, so this is sort of what people would do if they want to have the polymorphism spectrum which is directed with respect to an outgroup. So then they align these in-group genomes plus an outgroup genome, and so this information can be then recorded. It just gives a sequence of numbers, which just tells you how many individuals of the in-group differ at a given position from the out-group.
Is that a polymorphism that's a frequency of the polymorphism?
This is a moment, at the moment, is a frequency count series. 3 is the frequency, 3 out of 8, for example. It's a polymorphism. So this would be substitutions, and these positions were part of the in-group differs from the out-group is what we would call polymorphism, or what people call polymorphism.
3 out of 8 is the frequency.
And 3 out of 8 is the frequency. The out-group directed frequency, because if you didn't have the additional benefit of the out-group, you couldn't distinguish 3 out of 8 from 5 out of 8. So this is the additional information on directing this distribution that the out-group gives. This frequency count sequence can then be converted in a frequency distribution. by just saying, okay, let me take these 10,000 positions of the genome together and make a histogram out of them. For example, fourfold silent sites, intergenic regions, non-synonymous changes in proteins, these broad classes, which are sufficiently broad that we get enough counts, and sufficiently narrow that we don't lump together completely unreasonable averages. So how detailed we can do these categories where we lump things together to a distribution depends on time, namely on the amount of data increasing with time. So then what we get then in a given category is just a distribution of k, 1 to 8 in the previous example, but in these data that we used it was 12. And what does it depend on? It depends on the divergence time, because the number of substitutions is increasing with time. It depends on n times mu. The abundance of polymorphisms is essentially governed by that. And it depends on the selection characteristics, namely the amplitude and the driving frequency of selection. And we have an analytical expression for this frequency distribution. So this is what we mean by a model-based score. So we now have a model that triggers a certain amount of adaptation, and based on this model, we can predict this frequency distribution for, and k runs from 0 to 12, so substitutions and polymorphisms are lumped together in a single coherent distribution. This is what the word joint means. So they are not treated as separate classes, but sort of as one statistical entity. And this distribution can then be compared with a neutral expectation as a denominator, and we can form a log likelihood score, just as we formed it for the equilibrium problem above. And then we can use this log likelihood score to score our alignments. And so then we can do standard Bayesian or log likelihood analysis of these joint substitution and polymorphism spectra. And just to show you briefly that this more sort of comprehensive statistical method brings a considerable increase in statistical predicting power. So as a function of the selection strength and the driving rate, which really is just a reparametrization for the amount of positive selection you can have, so there is then a certain fraction of the changes that we see in the genome that are uphill changes, that are adaptive responses. And so in our model we know them, and they are faithfully reproduced by the inference method up to finite size effects. However, a standard population genetic test like the McDonald-Kreitman test would not do so. In fact, so there is a whole area in this parameter space where the McDonald-Kreitman test would not predict that there is a finite fraction of adaptive changes because of this masking effect that we discussed. There is simultaneously negative selection going on, and the McDonald-Kreitman ratio of these polymorphisms and substitutions would not be, or its inverse here would not be smaller than 1. So the McDonald-Kreitman test makes certain assumptions, or a sort of a coarse-grained version of the test that misses out on part of the adaptive changes going on. In other words, if the McDonald-Kreitman ratio is larger than 1, then this indicates adaptation, but the converse is not true. So there is a systematic underestimation. Of course, you're looking critical. I'm coming to this the thing with the population size. No, it means adaptive as defined. It means the surplus of uphill moves over downhill moves. This is how we defined it.
you're looking at sequences even more.
What do you mean? You don't.
You're looking at a particular state of affairs.
Well, any inference on polymorphism spectrum is doesn't know what happened at a given locus. So here we're comparing with it with a statistical model. This sort of statistical comparison test is for simulated data. So we have a fluctuating selection model. We record the polymorphism spectrum. We do the maximum likelihood analysis and compare to what on these simulated data a McDonald-Kreidman test would give. So here is what the real data look like. And you now do this analysis in FLY, and we took published data sets. There is by now an increasing amount of data from the last year. There's data from the Munich group, and Andor Fatto in a study about 1.5 years ago has done some additional sequencing. So we took these combined data and we looked at this combined spectrum of polymorphisms and substitutions. So here is a fourfold silence size is sort of our as neutral as possible gold standard, and indeed this combined distribution fits perfectly with a near-neutral distribution. Near-neutral meaning selection differences of order one. So there was no assumption that these fourfold silent sides be neutral implied in this study. It just sort of came out that there are the predicted sizes of weak selection effects. However, all the other classes are sort of course, as you see in their spectral properties, significantly deviating from the neutral expectation, but not only from the neutral distribution. So here the dashed line gives our best equilibrium model. Equilibrium model meaning no driving, gamma equals zero, and hence in our restrictive definition no adaptive changes, because adaptive changes were a non-equilibrium response to this driving force. So what we see here, like, is the best equilibrium fit to these data, and so you can't. So this line ends here. It's drawn a little bit badly, and the data point is up here. So this shows too few substitutions and too high polymorphism. In other words, it's absolutely incompatible with the data, and we can quantify this incompatibility by a p-value based on our Bayesian log likelihood analysis. Oh, here, I'm sorry, this point was here and this curve ends here. However, in the space of our models with driving, there is a curve that matches it well, that the curve ends where the data point is. And I'm afraid the same problem occurs here, that you can't really see the last data point, but in all the other classes, the equilibrium model badly fails in describing the data. In other words, so what we find when you do the maximum likelihood analysis is that, first of all, selection is stronger than previously expected, so we find some larger selection pressure. So this is again in units of 2n. I should mention that this by no means excludes that there is a lot of near-neutral evolution going on. This is averages over a given category, which can mean that a subset of sites has strong selection, and it just says something about the average in a given class. It does not say how many sites are affected by the evolution. So there is a lot of room for neutrality going on. But secondly, and this came more as a surprise, the inferred fluctuation rates are of the order of the order of magnitude of the neutral mutation rate. So this fitness landscape is by no means static, and this is why we like to call it a seascape rather than a landscape, at least what the local movements at individual genome positions is concerned. So you could say, if you look at this, if you think about this for a moment, then you conclude that this is almost certainly nonsense. Because you would say, well, if the fitness landscape changes at a rate comparable to the change, to the neutral change rate of the genome, then the genome would get completely confused. You would essentially get a random genome, because before the adaptation, because the adaptation could go on, the genome would already have changed again in its direction of fitness. But however, what preserves adaptation as a efficient mode of evolution is that the selection strengths are such that the substitution rate, the uphill rate, which governs these changes, this is faster than the change rate of the genome, so the genome can keep up with these changing selection pressures. So a side note is that when we do this maximum likelihood inference, then there is a dependence on the inferred of the inferred values on these genomic categories. So in UTRs and introns, there is sort of higher fluctuation rates, but consistently less amplitudes of fitnesses. So, in some sense, the non-synonymous changes in proteins come with a larger fitness amplitudes, but a lesser rate of fluctuation. And this is, of course, this means that the prediction of functional elements in intergenic regions can less be based on sequence conservation. So, if we accept for a moment, well, I should, maybe before I go to this interpretation, I should add, of course, that what we did, we were very careful to disentangle demographic effects from these fitness effects. So we also, what I didn't show here for clarity, but I'm happy to show you in detail, and also the corresponding paper should come out either today or tomorrow in PNAS, so it can be downloaded. We have done a very careful analysis of demographic effects. So we have modeled a model which has selection, but no time dependence in selection, so the only time dependence comes from the effective population size. And we have done the best fit of that model to the data, we call the demographic model, and we see that also by a large p-value, that model can be excluded. So we can disentangle population effects from the adaptation, from the presence of adaptation. And while I wouldn't make the same claim of all the population genetic tests alone, I would maintain that this method can distinguish adaptation from demographic effects.
Did you combine demographics with delta periods?
Yes. We combined static selection, of which we just assumed that it wasn't time dependent, with a general demography. So this is my final slide. So now this is here a place in the genome, and are this sort of these nucleotides that try to keep up with it. And so if it is true that the fitness is changing on that side, then of course we can ask, what are these dynamical reasons? Because at the moment, remember, although we lump together many positions of the genome in these spectra, the information lost is all the correlations. This is just how the analysis, the current data situation that is like this. But what can be these causes? So on the one hand, of course, an external change can trigger a fitness difference at a given locus. So, for example, if it was before good to have a slightly weaker binding site, so now this fly goes in a different environment, and it wants that binding strength a little bit stronger. So then there would be a change in fitness effects on the nucleotide position comprising that binding site. That would be one possible reason. But of course, what we think is a large part of this observed time dependence of the fitness at individual position comes from epistatic effects. That means fitness couplings to other positions in the genome. So you have a switch at another position, and these two are coupled in fitness, and this influences the fitness at another side, as in the Ludwig Kreitmann experiment that Tomoko Ota was describing this morning. So these two things can conspire together, of course, and they're coupled to other sort of non-fitness effects that we talked about, that different loci can be linked. And so you can, if something changes here, then you can also, the genome can change here as a result. So all these things conspire to make the dynamics at a given point in the genome. And, well, I should add one note to Susie Raymond's talk last week, because what Raymond and Lenski showed in the in these experiments, and Tomoko was mentioning this morning again, is that these two things are, of course, often highly intertwined. So an environmental change can trigger subsequent epistatic interaction. This is what Raymond and Lenski were describing for these bacteria populations. So when you have, and this is sort of a general sort of property of this kind of system, if we have two conditions, non-equilibrium and strong correlations, then you can, with one external signal, trigger a cascade of subsequent epistatic responses. And so this is, at the moment, the picture that we have, or the conjecture that we have for the causes of these time-dependent fitness effects observed in individual positions. So let me try to wrap this up quickly. So we've seen if in the landscape case, if systems can be argued to be at equilibrium, and this is something, as the discussion has shown, one has to ascertain in every case whether this is a reasonable assumption, then we can measure genomic fitnesses via abundances. And they are quite simple to measure. They're given just on sort of for a class of comparable object as by log likelihood score. So this is sort of establishes a link between bioinformatics and these dynamical properties. We've proposed a sort of rather stringent definition of adaptations as the excess of uphill moves over downhill moves at comparable sites. So we have illustrated this sort of with the dynamics at one site, where in an equilibrium situation you would have equal number of uphill and downhill moves, and in a non-equilibrium situation you would have more uphill moves. And we propose that as a sort of one way of defining adaptation at the molecular level, with this restrictive definition, which does not count every uphill move. Because you see that the problem is this mere neutral regime that Tomoko was talking about. How many of the uphill moves are really making the system better in a long-term scale, and how many are just the repair of a previous slightly deleterious mutation? This is sort of the statistical question that needs to be addressed, and this is one possible answer to that question. We have seen that substantial part of this Drosophila genome have both a non-trivial time dependence of the underlying fitness and have substantial selection coefficients at least part of their sites in these selected categories. That means the categories which are different from the fourfold silent sites, where we do not find this. Since the selection is sufficiently substantial, the adaptations are an efficient evolutionary mode, and that means that selection, while acting on the one hand as a constraint on those parts of the genomic sites which are adapted, it also is, for the changes that do happen, a major cause of these changes. And well, this was the last slide, that non-equilibrium plus correlations can make for an interesting sort of dynamics about, not so much about this combined picture is known theoretically. So So I would claim that sort of the evolutionary theory of these sort of combined epistatic non-equilibrium situation is a wide open field. Well, thanks a lot for your attention.
Yeah. How much do you think it matters that you treat the power group as if every polymorphism is fixed, whereas, of course, many of those sites may be polymorphic in the out group that are fixed in the polymorphic in singulants that are fixed in Langmuir, or they may be polymorphic in both. They may be polymorphic with the same polymorphism or with different polymorphisms.
Well, I mean, we don't really make that assumption because our theory gives the combined distribution of finding sort of k individuals in one and k in the other. So there is no special assumption that the site in the other population is fixed. But even if, so just experimental observation shows that the conserved polymorphism, so that means that the number of sites where you find polymorphisms in both species, for that data set, I shouldn't say that.
There could be cases where the ancestor would be differently inferred if you had a bigger sample for singulants.
Yes. So, of course, there would be informational content. So, at the present level, we have just one simulant sequence at our disposal plus a spectrum for melanogaster. So this is, and then we just use what the theory depicts on that particular sort of combination of sample sizes, namely 12 and 1. If we get data from the other species as well, then of course the analysis becomes more stringent. But sort of in first approximation, one would guess that most of the polymorphic sites that are there in Melanogaster would be monomorphic in simulants and vice versa. So it sort of would it be a p-square effect, but then we have to see how the data. Maybe there's a lot of balancing selection going on so that you see a lot of polymorphisms that are conserved as polymorphisms. We don't know. This data is not yet there.
Another thing, I guess I couldn't tell from what you showed. You didn't show very much actual data. But it looked to me that the data that I saw looked to me as if it was what I would predict based on deleterious polymorphisms and changed population size. I didn't see anything that looked to me like positive selection. I was sort of reminded of what Kimura said about selection, is that the selectionist would come up with some incredibly complicated model to show how selection would produce an effect that looked exactly like neutrality, which sort of seemed to me like what we see.
I would disagree with that completely. So we made a detailed analysis and we looked at a demographic model, and although these curves, I haven't shown them here, I can pull them up let me just show them to you. This is what you find if you click the paper that will be available this week. So there is the best equilibrium model, assuming constant population size and an arbitrary amount of selection which is static. And then there is the best demographic model, which assumes an arbitrary amount of selection in each class, no driving, so it's static selection, and an arbitrary variation of the population size, which again, so we can do a maximum likelihood analysis, and you would get at sort of the bottleneck structure that would best explain the data. You would choose an arbitrary population size distribution on the in-group branch, on the Drosophila melanogaster branch, and then the full line is the best is the best model with a constant population. Well, the best model which includes fluctuating selection. So what we can...
How many factors are there?
Well,
on the fluctuating model, how many parameters?
The fluctuating selection model has two parameters, namely strength of selection and rate of selection. So
I think for all species that exist in the world today, I mean, you could safely say that we know something about their demographic history. That is, we know that they had a bottleneck, which is very small compared to what their numbers are now, and that there's been a tremendous increase since, say, the last glaciation or something like that. And so that, I mean, if you fit a model that's based on our knowledge rather than one that just has arbitrary fluctuation, maybe you do a little better.
Well, okay, so if you look in the literature on Drosophila, so this is, I forgot to say this, this is African populations. So African populations have been chosen because the population structure is over the last, so here we're not talking about the full species history, but the last 1.5 or 2 million years since the speciation of Simulans and Melanogaster. So where people think that there have been in the Zimbabwe populations no, well, at least there is no knowledge of strong bottlenecks. So the literature differs in what the inferred bottlenecks are, but you can't say for this particular species there is no known bottleneck that you say, okay, well, there was this ice age and there had to be a bottleneck. So there is no knowledge base model that we could a priori fit on. So, and then the literature is far from unanimous on what the actual population structure is. And a lot of the predicted population structure is based on very simplified models which do not take into account selection. So this is also subject to a lot of discussion. So I think what we did here is the most honest thing that we could do. We assume an arbitrary population, time dependence of population size for this species, and we see what is the bottleneck structure that explains the data best. What we get is a bottleneck that is an early bottleneck that goes sort of from the time of speciation for a while, population size reduction, and then an increase in population size. We can sort of discard, if not fully exclude, very recent bottlenecks, because they would distort the polymorphism spectrum in fourfold silent sites more than we observe. So I think we have been as honest as we can for the population structure, and yet we find by a very clear p-value that these dash curves can just be excluded. In other words, why we cannot exclude that there were large population size variances, what we can exclude is that population size variation alone was responsible for the observed data. So the three parameters of the changes in selection.
Of the environment. I mean, you're what assuming environmental changes. So how does that come into the model?
But the definition of adaptation was different. The definition of adaptation was response to fluctuating in selection. So that explicitly includes
selection is a mirror of the changing environment. So what? Please remind me, how do you model a changing environment, namely the changing selection?
So the changing selection, and we leave open at this point because we cannot address it in a data analysis, whether this is due to epistatic effects, to pervasive epistasis, as argued in a number of studies, that they take place. Well, you are asking about environment, right?
Changing time.
And yes.
It's a function.
Yes.
Can you tell me what this function looks like?
I can. Yeah. Let me remind you what this function is. Let me just first explain that this function, which I'm going to tell you, is not defined as an environment effect. So it doesn't address directly your question. It's defined as
whatever is changing with time.
Whatever is changing with time. Let me just get rid of this thing. Whatever is changing with time is defined by this equation. Yes, let me try to answer one question at a time. It pays to answer one question at a time. Then, so this is the answer to your question. The F is the fitness difference at a given genomic position, which is then drawn from some distribution. So this is fitter allele fitness minus less fit allele fitness, delta F, and this is time dependent. And for the sake of model analyzability and not creating too many free parameters, it's modeled as a constant amplitude times a time dependent sign. So this variable chi is plus minus 1, and this sign switches.
I was asking, sign S-I-G-N or S-I-N-E?
Sign is plus minus 1.
Oh, so it just switches between two integers?
Yes.
In what frequency?
Gamma.
What is gamma?
Gamma is a rate that we determine from the data.
So it's a free parameter?
Yes. This is why I told you there's free parameters. There's two free parameters, gamma and F.
So how realistic is the assumption of constant F?
What? How real? Okay. We.
So your F is the yes. same of all yes. mutations, except some changes.
So the assumption is not very realistic. What we should ask is how much does it distort the analysis? So, of course, in the end, the selection amplitudes are drawn, like in all of these studies, from an unknown distribution. Because we are lumping together different genomic sites, there's an unknown distribution of fitness amplitudes at this site. And Tomoko was showing this morning one possible way of how they could go. So there is, since we are talking only about amplitudes and leave the sign together, with respect to what Tomoko showed this morning, we would add up the left-hand and the right-hand side of this curve and would get a certain amplitude curve, for which we then, as everybody who does this analysis in the data, would then have to find a suitably simple parameterization that doesn't overfit. So the way we do it, we sort of take the fraction of neutral sites plus the average selection on the selected side. So we get two more parameters for this amplitude distribution. This is very similar to what all the inference methods do, because this distribution is unknown. So now your question was, shouldn't we, for example, do a better model? And so that there were more realistic models. I told you there's a long history of this fluctuating selection model. A slightly better model could be, well, with a certain rate gamma, discard the old selection value and draw a new one from a distribution. Then the amplitude wouldn't stay constant, but it would be redrawn every switch afresh. This would be an alternative model. Numerical analysis shows that it doesn't make a big difference whether you constrain the amplitude, because you anyway have a whole sample of amplitudes in your distribution.